Welcome to the Next Level Soul Podcast, where we ask the big questions about life. Why are we here? Is this all there is? What is my soul's mission? We attempt to answer those questions and more by bringing you raw and inspiring conversations with some of the most fascinating and thought-provoking guests on the planet today. I am your host, Alex Ferrari. I'm always looking to help the Next Level Soul audience take their soul to the next level. And I've been able to partner with Mind Valley to present you guys with a ton of free masterclasses between 60 and 90 minutes covering mind, body, soul, relationships, and conscious entrepreneurship. Some of these masterclasses are taught by spiritual masters, relationship experts, best-selling authors, legends in the personal growth and spirituality space, and so much more. So if you want to sign up for any of our free mind, body, and soul masterclasses, just head over to nextlevelsoul.com/free. Now, today on the show, we have spiritual advisor and poet Mark Nepo. And Mark has taught in the field of spirituality for over 40 years and is best known for his New York Times number one bestseller, The Book of Awakening. I cannot tell you the profound conversation that Mark and I had in this episode. It moved me to my spiritual core, and I cannot wait for you guys to hear this journey into a soul. So let's dive in. I'd like to welcome to the show Mark Nepo. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I've been looking at your stuff over the years, and you're doing a lot of good for the world. You're trying to spread the word. So I'm hopefully we're here to help you spread the word a little bit more about your teachings and what you've been doing. And you've had an interesting journey, to say the least. But I wanted to take you back for my first question to the day that you found the lump in the back of your head. Can you tell the audience about that day?
Yeah, so obviously you're referring to my cancer journey years ago, and we're talking almost 35 years ago.
Wow.
And I was in my early 30s. I was teaching at Albany University and writing away and trying to find my voice. And I just had this growth that was growing on my skull bone back here. And it didn't have any pain, but it was becoming pretty obvious that there was something large there growing. And so I finally went to a doctor and was told that I probably had a rare form of lymphoma, and, you know, fell into this, the heat of it was a 3-year journey. But I want to pause here to share that first appointment that day really came back to me during the pandemic, because, you know, when I, of course, I was just stunned and said, can you double check? Are you sure you have the right folder?
Right.
But leaving that appointment, the door I had come through to keep that appointment was gone. There was no way back to life before that appointment. And I feel like that's what the pandemic has done to humanity. The old world is gone. No matter how we cry, deny, get angry, bemoan it, it's gone. And the only thing is to love each other forward. And so, but back to, you know, my journey. So I went through a 3-year period where that tumor was growing in my skull bone and grew to the size of a grapefruit.
And wow.
Yeah. It was, you know, unbelievable. And I went through, you know, all kinds of, oh God, gauntlet of tests and biopsies and everything. And that tumor vanished, and it was a miracle. And I was just kind of spit back out into life. And that was so dramatic that there was a sister tumor growing on a rib in my back, which no one noticed. I didn't notice. And about 10 months later, that started to grow and I was back in. And that time, you know, the miracle appeared differently. That time, you know, I wound up having to have that rib surgically removed. And then I had to go through 4 months of very intense chemo, which almost killed me. And so I learned, I mean, several things, but I learned that miracle is a process, not an event. And even the damn chemo was part of the miracle. And so, you know, a couple of things that were real crucial for me, which I think just speak to what everyone goes through. It's just when we're ill or when we're faced with a crisis, it's in greater relief. But they're really the same spectrum of choices all human beings sooner or later face. And so the first thing was that, you know, before that experience, I was a driven young artist, you know. And I woke up on the other side really so grateful to be here, but really perplexed because my drive was gone. And I was very confusing. And I said, wow, I'm glad to be here, but did I lose my gift? Did I lose my passion? What's going on here? And it took several months, but then I discovered that I was now drawn to things, not driven. And it was actually more freeing and deeper. And the image I've come to understand around that is it's like a river, a mighty river. When it's going down and its banks are steep, it makes a lot of noise. But when it reaches the mouth of the sea, it doesn't disappear. That river joins more deeply the greater ocean. And so it's there, but it's quieter. And that's what happened to me. My gift just appeared differently. The other thing that happened through all of this was that before all this, I was in my head a lot, you know. And even though I was heart-centered, I talked about it a lot from the head. But through no wisdom on my part, you know, I was shaken up, inside out, upside down. And then after that, everything kind of melted into my heart. And that was the center going forward. And my mind has served my heart ever since. And the third thing, and then I'll pause, is that, you know, I was raised Jewish and I have a great tie to the Jewish heritage, but I had so many people from all walks of life, formal and informal, including atheists and scientists and Native Americans and Sufi prayer groups. I had so many people be kind enough to bless me and help me and offer things that when I woke up still here, I was not, and all these later years later, I'm still not wise enough to know what worked and what didn't. And so I feel that I was challenged to believe in everything. And so ever since then, all my work, all my books, all my teaching, I am a student of all paths. And what I feel is the common center of all paths and the unique gifts of each.
You know, it's really interesting when you say being drawn and driven. And that's something really interesting because when you're driven, it's coming from the mind. It's coming from the head. When you're being drawn, it's coming from spirit, from my interpretation of it. And throughout my life, I've been driven. I too am a driven artist. So I understand that. And only now as I get older, do I realize that yes, there's a certain amount of drive you need to get the ball rolling. You know, you gotta, you know, you gotta get up, gotta get out of the house. You know, you gotta submit things, you gotta do the work, and you gotta do that, and that's fine. But being drawn to a certain mission, being drawn to a certain idea of why you are here and how that works into you being an artist or whatever your skill set might be, is something that I'm working through as we speak. So it's really interesting when you said that, that really just checked something in my head really quickly. I wanted to kind of dive deeper into that because I feel that so many of us are, we live our lives through our head, our mind, our logic, and just think too much.
Yeah.
And not feel enough. And I know that might sound woo-woo to people listening, but if you're listening to this show, you're pretty woo-woo. but in generally,
it's essential. It's essential.
Right?
It's only called woo-woo by people who are uncomfortable with exploring it. So
correct.
So let's look a little bit at effort and grace.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I believe in effort because I don't know when grace is going to show up. And so, you know, in terms of writing, I push the pen until it pulls me, you know, and
I love that. I'm sorry. I have to stop there for a second. That is such a great quote there. I push the pen until it pulls me. And you know, on my other shows, I speak to a lot of high-end Oscar-winning writers and things like that. I've never heard anyone say it like that. And that is, so you type and now you move the fingers on the keyboard until someone else takes control of the keyboard.
Well, this goes, so let's look at effort and grace and about this deep sense of being drawn to things versus driven. And you know, grace for me is when, and a great image for this is surfing. So the effort, a surfer paddles out, gets through the surf, gets out there, waits, paddles, and then if they're lucky and blessed, there's a wave. Now, it doesn't matter if it's a small wave, it's a great wave, if it's a once-in-a-lifetime wave, no wave lasts forever. But for the duration that the surfer is riding the wave, they are one with the wave. And then the wave ends, and you're thrown back into effort. And you may come back on shore, or you may paddle back out. But this rhythm between effort and grace, and we can use that to talk about whether it's creativity or compassion or care. You know, in that moment when we're riding the wave in the life of compassion, we are one with all those who hurt. In the moment of love, we are one with love. We become, right. In that moment of riding the wave, we are love. In that moment of integrity, we are truth. And because we're human beings, no one can stay there. But those moments of grace, of unity, of oneness, they inform everything. They inform the rest of our life. We learn from them. I've learned from them. I grow from them. And then I come back and on shore and go, wow, what's going on there? What happened? So a lot of this, when we look at it, I think that humbly we have very little control in life. We basically can control our presence and our absence. And I think everything comes from our presence, which means holding nothing back, giving over, being completely open-hearted. And so when I'm confused or troubled or in fear or pain, I try to give my full attention to the nearest piece of life. It could be dust on a windowsill. I give my full attention until it becomes my teacher. I give over completely. And so this leads to the difference between giving attention and getting attention. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we do have to do the work. We have to, you know, I mean, even it doesn't matter about whether it's creative or not. You want a job, you got to make a resume. You're saying, hey, give me a look. That's fine. And that's necessary in the outer world of circumstance. When we get in trouble is when we take that getting attention to identify our worth. Our worth comes from giving attention. Our worth comes, you know, when I was before I had language for this as a boy, you know, I I wonder came by giving attention, by recognizing and verifying. And in truth, I initially started writing for two reasons. I mean, one was I would see something amazing and then it would be gone. And I go, wait a minute, wait, I didn't get it. You know, like, and I would write to keep, like taking a verbal snapshot to keep the wonder in view a little longer, a little longer. Now, of course, the second reason I started writing was because the first woman in high school that I loved dumped me and broke my heart. And I wasn't a loner, but I didn't have close friends till college. So that was a way to start healing. And of course, as I started healing, I realized I wasn't talking to myself. I had begun a conversation with the universe.
So to go back to that analogy of the wave and the surfer, many of us do the effort. And when you're driven, you're constantly going out to try to catch the wave. But at a certain point, the ego comes into play and it believes that by the effort that you're doing, you are either entitled to the wave or you actually control the wave that's coming. And that's where, am I wrong in that? Is that a fair?
No, absolutely. And that's one of our human frailties.
Right. But so doing the effort, it's kind of like showing up and like as a writer, we show up every day, we write, and then occasionally the muse shows up and something comes through you. But you have to show up every day. A lot of the writers I've spoken to over the years, they say, I just show up at 8 o'clock every day in the morning to start writing. I let the muse know that I'll be there. If she wants to show up, she'll know where I'm at. But you need to go every day and be there to let them know what this, to let her know where you are.
Well, and part of the difference between being driven and drawn is that when we show up, and this is why it's to me more of a relationship than the fact, you know, so let me back up a second. So sure. In the Western world, we tend to, through the ego, we pump ourselves up as artists, regardless of the form, like we're little gods.
Oh, absolutely.
We create everything.
It all and we have little worlds and we have our own little universe.
Right. And that's just not true. You know, we are living parts in a living whole, whole. And it's a relationship with the unknown. It's a relationship of the part with the living universe. And therefore, once the effort is put in, we have to be open to discover what's there. To writing over the years has become listening and taking notes, not directing material where I think it should go. And so, you know, when I was young, like all writers and all artists, really, I was taught to be on the look for good material. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, almost dying from cancer, one of the other gifts I was given was the lens of the miraculous. That is, everything's part of the miracle. Everything's mm-hmm. miraculous. So if I'm open-hearted and present enough, everything is worth exploring, is worth putting words to, is worth listening to. And therefore, it's not about good material. It's about verifying the miracle of what is in as specific detail as possible. And that's where stories come that you can't make up. You know, that's where images, that's where you overhear a conversation and there's sudden truth in it. And so, and then we like inner prospectors, we pick it up and go, my God, what's here? So this is one of the hardest things to teach young writers is, and me too when I was young, you know, you finally have a vision, you have something you think is worth exploring or writing about or putting down, and then you put all that effort in and then it doesn't stand still. Then it doesn't, you know, and we in our ego think, oh, I missed, I didn't aim right. I missed it. No, it's as if when you put in enough effort and work, just like you were saying, other people have said, it's as if the muse, I would go even beyond the muse and say the living universe, the essential presence of spirit says, oh, okay, now that I see you're serious, I'm going to show you what this is really about. Pay attention.
So you also mentioned a little while ago that you found your voice. And I know you, I think you meant the voice as of a writer, but I think you also meant it as a deeper concept of finding your voice, where it could be, I'm interpreting it as you found your mission, your purpose in what you're here to do in this life. So many of us have problems finding that purpose. What advice do you have for people who are lost, who are, in the rat race, or just unhappy, or just don't feel where they need to be? Because I know for myself, it took me a while to find what I'm doing and find the love for it, because I was angry. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Probably over a decade. Easily angry until I was like, oh, this is where I need to be. So it took me a while to find my own voice, my own mission in life. So what advice do you have for people who are struggling?
Well, I think, and again, when we talk like this, which is wonderful, I want to be clear that I don't have any answers. What I share are examples, not instructions, and we're just comparing notes.
Fair enough. Fair
That's
enough.
all we can do. And so, from my experience, I have found that the most important thing is to follow what will bring your heart alive, and the rest will become your teacher. So, it's while it's understandable, what's my purpose? What can I do? How can I make that happen? I think when we start out by just, I often now offer this question, this kind of daily inventory, to ask, whatever's before you, is it heartening or disheartening? If it's heartening, I'm in. If it's disheartening, what am I doing there? Regardless of what my mind says. And then you start to build a reservoir of resources that are heartening. And the soul, I believe, this is the difference to me between the call of the soul and the soul's calling. The call of the soul is, I believe the soul, it just wants your heart to be as alive as possible. And just like fire, a fire doesn't care what kind of wood you put on it. Elm, pine, cherry, no. And I think the soul, it doesn't matter to the soul what form of care you put on it. Care makes the soul burn bright. And through care, we discover where we can apply that aliveness in life. So you might love to help things grow. We need to nurture that. There are many forms that can take. You could be a therapist, you could be a teacher, you could be a gardener. There's all kinds of things. So, but the most important thing is to nurture how the heart comes alive, and then it'll become apparent, where that can be of most use. So there's another metaphor I like to use for this, and that's of a wooden match. So we all know that the tip of that match in the phosphorus, that the flame is dormant there. It does not release its light or heat until it strikes against a surface. So too our gifts. Our gifts are dormant until they strike against the needs of the world and they come alive. And so often, there was a great, this is why the inextricable link between inner work and service. So there was a great Hindu teacher, Ramana Maharshi from the 1800s. And Ramana Maharshi, among many things, but he said this about, he said, to try to save the world without first liberating yourself is like carpeting the earth rather than wearing sandals. Yeah, let me say, yeah, to try to save the world without first liberating yourself is like carpeting the earth rather than wearing sandals. And that's why it's so important to do the inner work to find what brings your heart alive and then see where that can be of service. So, okay, go ahead.
So let me ask you a question, because I'm going to go a little deeper, dig a little deeper into this concept, because many times you as a soul will have a gift. Let's say, you know, a certain gift is singing, and you're very good at singing, and you love singing, and you truly love it, and you go down the path of becoming a singer. But it doesn't work out in the way that your mind thinks it should. You should be a big star, or you should be, you know, have a record deal, or you should be making money or making a living at singing. But yet the talent is there and the love is there. It really does fill the heart up. And only years later, after struggle, do you discover that the skill sets that you learned along the way while you were singing played a part in the bigger mission, that you needed that element in order to create the bigger mission that you're truly there to do. And that's a very difficult pill for a lot of people to swallow in many ways. Yeah,
so
sometimes
let me speak into that this way. So, and this has to do with, again, whether we're giving attention or getting attention,
mm-hmm.
where we are, because we tend in this world to commodify everything, including mm-hmm. our souls. So, you know, we're not, so you're in the schoolyard, and at recess you're spinning around and you're singing, and your teacher says, you know, you got a great voice, you should be a singer. Okay, and that's fine, and maybe you devote yourself to that or not, but then something happens and we say, well, how do I know I'm a singer? If someone tells me I am, if I'm recorded, if I, you know, perform
record
at a
deal.
Concert or right. at a club. And that is a way of, that's one path, but that has nothing to do. So what happens is we go out in the world and we become a noun. But what's life-giving, what brings the soul alive, is stay a verb. If you like singing, just sing. Just sing.
For the love of singing.
Well, the singing is what brings your soul alive. Yes, if you want to do that and it's frustrating and you don't get recognized, that's its own journey, and that's difficult, and there's rejection, and there's a whole other set of things we learn by going through that.
Mm-hmm.
That has nothing to do with our worth. That's a separate journey.
Be a verb.
That's a separate journey. So, you know, there's a novel by Aldous Huxley,
mm-hmm.
The philosopher who wrote The Perennial Philosophy. And but it's a novel called Antic Hay. And it's set in the early part of the 1900s in London. And it has this clique of artists and writers, and they all gather at this cafe, and they're, you know, having wonderful conversations. But the one painter in the group, this guy, he's the main character. And when you're with him, he has vision like nobody has ever had. He's just, what he sees and what he understands about painting is just phenomenal. He can't paint. He doesn't paint well. He can't, when he goes to put it on the canvas, it doesn't work. But he's so passionate and has such a love and is so alive, more alive than all these other people. And they come together, and the other more intellectual people in the circle, they actually kind of make fun of him without him knowing it by asking him questions, and he leaves and they tee-hee. But the whole point of the novel by Huxley is, who's the real artist? Is it all these intellectual Zorros who are swinging their swords everywhere? Or is it this painter who sees more deeply into the mystery of life, but he doesn't have the skill to put it on the canvas? So who's the real artist?
So my question to you is, if he has that great skill, Why hasn't he? Well, it's probably, I'm answering my own question as I'm telling, asking it to you. It's because he has lessons to learn around that. And that's something that he has to walk through. I mean, we can use Van Gogh as an example.
Sure.
I mean, he painted obsessively throughout his life, never had an ounce of recognition. He died penniless, and yet now considered one of the greatest artists of all time. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. And that was a lesson. He went mad. He literally was in a sanitarium.
Well, and he and Monet, you know, were seeing more deeply than any painters to that point. And in fact, the French prime minister at the time, Clemenceau, who was a friend of Monet's, this was at the same time that the microscope was being discovered. And Clemenceau said about, especially about Monet and Van Gogh, because, you know, at the beginning, people weren't accepting Impressionism. They were going, what's going on here? And he said, no, you don't understand. Painters like Monet and Van Gogh are like human microscopes. They are seeing at the level of energy. So that, you know, there's a whole nother thing about why Van Gogh didn't get strength from what he knew, and that's not to fault him. It was tragic, and we can learn from that. But the inner rewards, the aliveness that came, you know, so this brings up the difference between, and this is not just for artists, this is for any soul on earth. And this is archetypal, we all go through this, the difference between what we want and what we're given. And in my life, at least, I have learned that it doesn't mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with working for what you want and having goals and ambitions, but I think we all hold them too tightly. We make gods, we want something or we see it and then we make a god out of it. And the truth is that I have discovered my gifts because working for what I want has often turned out to be an apprenticeship for working with what I've been given.
It's very interesting too, because if you look at, you know, let's say someone is born extraordinarily beautiful. They have physical gifts beyond you and I, and everywhere they walk, they're just magnets for people, you know, as beautiful people tend to be. And many of them like, oh, you should be an actor or you should be a model. And that is what they've been given. They've been given this amazing tool, this amazing gift. Some go down that path, but others are like, nah, you know what I really want to do? I want to be a scientist. I really just want to help the world that way. But they are stunning. I mean, ridiculously stunning. And it's interesting that certain people choose things many times in life that don't associate closely with what gifts they've been given, regardless if they want to go down those roads. And they might have just be a test. Like if you're given this gift, the universe is like, okay, let's see where they go with this. Because so many people throughout their life are going to continue to tell them, you should model. Oh my God, you're so beautiful. Oh, this or that. And to maintain a place of being wanting to give and to give attention, as you said, as opposed to get attention and to give being a scientist, let's say, or a writer or an intellectual, whatever it is, even hospice, whatever. It's fascinating. And I've seen people like that. I've met people like that. And then I've met the other people who have no business trying to be a model or an actor and are angry and bitter because they're not getting where they want to go. But I'm like, those aren't the gifts that you were given. It's something you want. And I love that concept that you said, it's what you, something you want, and then and instead of using what you've been given. So I always use the example, I'm like, let's say I want to be an NFL player. I don't have those gifts, nor the age at this point. Though Tom Brady does give us hope. But generally speaking, I did want that when I was younger, as many young boys do. But eventually I realized, yeah, I don't have what it takes to get to that place. So you let that kind of go to the side.
It's just a fascinating conversation.
Well, I think that one of the paradoxes that we have to face as human beings, as a spirit in a body in time on earth, is the fact that the spirit in us simply wants to be. We don't have to become anything. It is we and our humanness that say, well, can I do something with it? We don't have to do anything. We don't have to become any. I mean, and a great teacher for this are flowers. Let's look at this a little closely, like a flower. A flower, whether they're planted or whether it's wildflowers, they start with a seed in the ground. So that seed, before it has any experience of light, it starts growing full force toward an element it doesn't have any conception of. It hasn't experienced light, and yet it's growing toward it so forcefully that it finally breaks ground. Now it grows in two directions. It grows inwardly and outwardly. It grows roots and shoots. And then when it's strong enough, it starts to form the flower itself. And when a flower blooms, what is it actually doing? It is revealing its beauty by turning inside out. That's what a blossom is. And it does this without going anywhere. I think this is a good model for what it is to be a soul on earth. Now we have there's lots of places to go and things to do. But that's, again, not at the core of our being. So, you know, and it's not about, oh, well, therefore we should just sit around and meditate all the time. No, we should be out doing things and bringing that energy and light and care wherever we go. But it's not, let me give you a story. This is a wonderful, two stories.
Mm-hmm.
One is about the story of a Japanese monk, Tetsugen, lived in the 1700s. And his call, his vision, what he wanted to do from a very early age is the talks of Buddha had not yet been translated into Japanese. And he said, that's my thing. I want to do that. I'm going to do that. And he had an artist friend. He said, look, you will carve these beautiful woodblock prints, and I'll translate the talks of Buddha, and we'll go around and beg for money to publish it, and we'll do this. So they were very passionate as young men. They started out, they worked, and about 8-9 years into it, the northwest part of Japan where Tetsugen came from had a flood like Katrina. He gave all the money away, started over, kept translating. His friend kept painting and drawing and doing wood blocks and then printing them. And they again, another 10, 12 years, and now there was a famine in another part of Japan. But after the first thing, he said, well, just because I didn't grow up with these people, what's the difference? He gave it all away. And after 25 years, Tetsugen published the Holy Talks of Buddha in Japanese for the first time with those beautiful prints. And today there is an original copy in the museum in Kyoto, and under it there's a plaque that reads, in his lifetime Tetsugen published 3 versions of the holy text. Only one is visible.
Oh, that's beautiful.
One is visible. Now here is an example that he was called to translate the talks of Buddha, the teachings of Buddha. He was really meant to do that by embodying it and living it. Writing it in words in another language was what he thought he was supposed to do. Now, he was able to do both. He did what he wanted and he did what he was given. It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes what we want burns up to ignite what we're given. You know, so here's another small story. This is, so this, I just want to refer to two you know, everything we're talking about is at the heart of one of my books called Drinking from the River of Light, Life of Expression. The entire book is about all of this. The story I'm going to tell is a very short story, and it opens a book of teaching stories of mine called As Far as the Heart Can See.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
So in this story, there's a professional cyclist, like a Tour de France cyclist, and he is into it. I mean, he's got all the state-of-the-art equipment, he's training, and he's shaved all the hair on his body so he has no resistance, and he's ready. And you know, the day of the race comes, the first leg is out in the country, and he's doing so well in the first mile or two that they come over a hill. He's coasting at a great speed down the hill, and briefly, he's so far ahead, you can't see the other cyclists. And as he comes down the bottom of the hill, coasting, out of nowhere, a great blue heron with its wings spread swoops over his handlebars. And he's stunned. And he literally stops and straddles his bike. The other racers are catching up, and he stops because the heron has opened something he's been chasing. And now we flash ahead several years, and he's living where he's living, and he's looking in the woods behind his house. And once in a while, if you ask him, what cost you the race? He'll say, I didn't lose the race. I left it.
Ooh, that's an analogy for life if I've ever heard of one.
And now you know, somebody will hear that story and say, well, that's all very poetic, but he did lose the race. He didn't come in first. But I hold it differently.
Yeah.
Because I think he trained to meet the heron, which changed his life. And if you told him he was training to meet a heron, he wouldn't have trained.
Oh, oh my God. It's just... Oh, I think this is like a therapy session for me, Mark. I appreciate this. I'm like, so many things are flying, and like, I'm just using my own life in my head going, oh God, he's right.
Well, so what often we, that's why it's important to have goals, but to hold them loosely, because we train for what we can see so that when the heron appears, whatever form it's in, we don't miss it. We go, oh. And so let me back up just to our earlier conversation about creative process. So when I retrieved that story, which I say rather than wrote it, I didn't know that was going to happen. I didn't know the heron was going to show up. I'm not that smart. No. But and I share this because it's an introspective process, not just the creative process. I pursued the story and what felt true, and the reward is that I was shown, okay, now we're going to give you the heron.
It's so fascinating because, I mean, I'll use my life as an example, as we should, as teachers, we use our own experiences. And for most of my life, my goal was to be a professional filmmaker. And I had decent success. I made a living. Let's just put it that way. I made a living doing that for over 25 years. And so many of the skill sets that I picked up along the way got me to start a podcast 7 years ago. And who did I interview? Filmmakers, because that's what I know. And those skill sets grew. And a lot of the tools in the toolbox that I've picked up over the years, I'm now using on a show like this. Now, if you would have told me that you're going to have a spiritual podcast 20 years ago, I would have said, what's a podcast? But secondly, let's say a radio show, I would have said, you're absolutely mad. I would never do anything. I'm not that guy. So it's really interesting to start looking at all of that
And then where I've truly found my happiness is doing this. This is remarkable to me. And I've been dealing with this and kind of coming to grips with this for the last five years, let's say, of my journey. Because first it was a little side hustle. Then all of a sudden I'm like, no, I really kind of like this. Really enjoy this. And then it really kicked into high gear when I started this show over a year ago, which is like, you know what? I feel like I'm good at the filmmaking and screenwriting side. That's great. But I really want to go deeper. And then I launched this show. And then I had a lot of my own journey with this show. But it's fascinating. Everything we're talking about, I could just start picking out parts of my life where it makes sense. Because there was no one more driven than me in regards to working hard for the dream that I had.
Yeah.
And that dream is not gone. It sits there in the back. And I still work, but it doesn't have the importance. I'll tell you what, when I first started that dream, it was about getting attention. It was not about giving attention. Yeah. Where now any projects that I walk into or start in that space is about serving. It's about giving to others and not as much about me getting the attention. Yeah. And that's a very big distinction.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that so honestly too, because so many of us experience this, and this is, you know, so the dream, I mean, the lesson of the heron is that the dream gets transformed
right
into something we couldn't have imagined. It actually opens us up to new ways of being, deeper ways of being, mm-hmm. and relating to life. And, likewise for me, I was teaching at Albany University when my cancer journey hit me. And, I was hoping maybe if I worked hard enough, maybe I'd write one or two poems that might be great and be add to the literature. And then, all of a sudden I'm in the hospital, forget writing great poems.
Right.
I need to discover true poems that would help me live. And now all these years later, I just want to be the poem.
You're right. You're absolutely right. So with everything that we've been saying, Mark, there's so many people. I think most people have a problem with everything we're talking about here. It's a journey. It's life's journey. It's generally life's journey. What can we do in your experience, in your notes that you've taken on your life, that you can give us in regards to how we can connect more to spirit, to be more of that giver of attention than getter of attention?
Well, I think, and again, my experience is that so much comes back to being fully present. You know, the difficult things in life make us recoil, fear, pain, confusion, despair, they make us go, oh, and we get tight, and we pull back. And our job in those moments is to go the other way and lean in. And that takes a quiet courage, because everything's telling you, wait, what do you mean lean in? Not now. No, that's exactly when we need to lean in. Lean in wholeheartedly. And no one, being human beings, no one can do it all the time. But I'm committed to being wholehearted, even though sometimes, because I'm human, I'm half-hearted. Okay? So a commitment to hold nothing back, and a commitment to a life of question. Mm. This is sorely needed today, because when we're too certain about what we think we know, then all we start to do is look for things that will confirm what I already know. That's not education.
All right.
Education is, thank God you're not me. Tell me something I don't know. Because we're more together than alone. So I think in very detailed, specific ways, I invite anyone who's listening to begin a journal of aliveness that chronicles and bears witness to your own rhythms of aliveness. That is, when are you wholehearted? What triggered that? Did it come from within? Did it come from without? Was it being with a certain person? Was it being in nature? Was it singing? Was it reading? Was it, you know, what was it? What were the conditions? Do make your life your case study, your inner life your case study, so that you can learn, you can become intimate with your own nature. And as we become more intimate with our own nature, we start to understand what brings us alive. And that's the teacher.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's the teacher. You know, in the Hindu tradition, there's a term Upa Guru, which means the teacher that is next to you at this moment. There's always a teacher next to you at this moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Always. And at this moment, it is you, sir, for me. Without question. Now, and you said something really interesting, that we should look for other ideas, other things, teach me things that I don't know. Don't look for things that reinforce what I know. And do you believe that that is what's going on in the world today, that we are all boxing ourselves up with social media and so many things, that we just keep hearing our same thoughts reinforced again and again?
Well, in talking about where we are today, and of course, I don't have any answers. I'm as mystified and frustrated as everyone about how we are where we are. But that's a whole deep conversation, which could take a whole nother hour. But let me begin to speak to it. You know, my new book is coming out just in September called Surviving Storms. Mm-hmm. And in there, I open that book with my guess at how we are where we are. And I think, so just to touch on a couple of things, because yes, let me kind of flesh out a little more what you were starting to suggest. I think that there's kind of a perfect storm of a lot of different things that have been going on for a couple of hundred years. And, you know, so, but right now in our age, I think there's a large part of our society that have lost their direct connection to life. And without that, we also lose our reverence for life. And so all the things we've been talking about not only are good for the individual, but they're good for society, because only by restoring our direct connection of life can we revere life. And then we won't hurt each other. I mean, one of the things that was so like baffling to me when I witnessed on TV the insurrection. Mm-hmm. In January 6th, that year ago, was these people were, forget cause, forget why, forget what, these people were barbarically violent. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they were taking pictures of themselves.
Right.
They were so dissociated, violent and dissociated, as if they were in a video game.
Right.
So one of the things is that without that direct connection of life, we and you look at the advent of reality TV culture over the last 50 years, we have lost touch with what is real. And violence, at some level, is a last attempt to feel, distorted last attempt to feel. The need to feel doesn't go away. So, you know, we have all these things, you know, one of the things is that, so this reality TV culture, for instance, I don't think anybody designed it, but it's a vicarious way. You know, it's interesting. Everybody wants to be a celebrity when everyone is secretly aching for something real to celebrate.
True.
Right? So, you know, what happens is you're invested, you're in your alone in your home, your apartment, you're invested in these shows, you're voting, you think it gives you the illusion that you have a relationship, and then you expend all this heart and energy, and then it's over, you turn it off, and you're still alone. And so what's happened in one level is, you know, you go back into Roman times, the Roman Colosseum. The Roman Colosseum was deliberately created to dissipate rebellious energy of the masses. That is, they got people all revved up watching gladiators and lions and all this stuff. And then when they went home, they didn't have enough energy to demand a better life.
Yeah.
So yeah. Today, the whole reality TV culture, now the Romans, they designed that. I don't think anybody designed it in the modern world. I think it's today that's our inadvertent virtual Colosseum. So people have lost their connection to life. They've dissipated their energy to do anything about it. And then you put on the whole social media that we're all in our bubbles. And so there's all this energy coming out that the world is gone as we've known it. And so there's all this energy coming out that is where intensity is mistaken for meaning. Yeah. Intensity is just stimulus. It's not meaning. And so how do we get out of this? I don't know, but I do believe that all the tools from all the traditions are not abstract. They are tools waiting to be used for times like this. And this happens to be our turn. You know, in my parents' generation, it was World War II. Every generation is challenged with something as to, are we going to choose love over fear? Are we going to show up? Are we going to be kind? Are we going to hunker down in self-interest? And so it's kind of our turn.
So our great war is social media in many ways and reality shows. Because you know what? Look, social media is like any tool. It is wonderful and it could be damaging. It could be used for both.
It's a tool.
And I see many people spreading much love and information and good knowledge out there and making people think through social media. And then there's the other side as well. Just like a hammer could kill somebody, it can build a house.
Absolutely.
It's a tool. So where we are at is so interesting, because I'm sure in your book as well that you talk about, it's not just one thing that's off. There's a thousand things. It seems like there's so much happening now where it's political strife, economic strife, environmental strife. There's so much stuff happening, political, everyone's so divided, more so than, I mean, I know we've been divided politically in the past. There's no question, especially here in the United States, but there's something different about this. It's a really different place. So there's so much going on. It seems like and also the pandemic as well, there seems to be something that is very much like you said at the beginning of our conversation. Your lump is what is the equivalent of what is happening to us, not just with the pandemic. I think in the list of the other things I just said, are the cancer scare for society, because something has to change. We can't keep moving towards the direction.
And I think that, you know, what the things we're facing are real.
Yeah.
And so not to minimize them. And I would offer that if you imagine, you know, take a look at me physically, my body. If I have one more healthy cell than toxic, I'm considered healthy. I'd like a lot more, but as long as I got one, I'm leaning toward health. Humanity is a global body. Every soul is a cell in that body. So everything we do, including our conversation, everything we do that is life-giving is one more healthy cell in the global body. And we have to stay committed to that. And then the other thing I would share is, in doing work on another book that I did called More Together Than Alone, I was looking at community across history and different cultures. And you know, in the Middle Ages in Europe, which we call the Dark Ages, actually the rest of the world at that time was pretty enlightened. It was just Europe. We whitewash it. Oh, it's the whole world was dark.
No, it was pretty. India, they were pretty. They were on the right path
India,
over there.
Asia,
China, Asia, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right. Everybody had something.
Even the Native Americans had it more together than the Europeans did.
But in Europe, for only 10% of the European population was literate. That 10% kept literacy alive for over 300 years. So if we are in a dark time, or if we are in a strident time, when we are awake, because we take turns being awake and asleep, when we are awake, it is incumbent on us to keep the literacy of the heart alive, mm-hmm. not to be snuffed out.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's absolutely beautiful. There's something that you said in another an interview I saw called the notion of shadow. I think it's important to kind of bring that concept into where this conversation, because I think it relates.
Yeah, so the notion of shadow, and that's not mine, that really was coined by or imagined by Carl Jung, mm-hmm. and the great psychologist of the unconscious. And what he talked about was that, and shadow wasn't bad or evil or dark. It was the unconscious or unlooked at parts of our humanity and parts of our mind and heart. And by not looking at that, not processing it and looking at it, it gets empowered and it comes out sideways. So, you know, in a person's life, if you have a fear of something, it can come out sideways if you don't face it. Mm-hmm. You know, and in our society, we can see whole groups of our society are, I think, in my opinion, are acting out of shadow right now. You know, people wanting something to believe in, and they're believing in hoaxes. They're so right. desperate for something to believe in that they'll give their entire passion.
And life, possibly.
And life. You know, the last week or whatever, excuse me, last week or whatever, after the FBI searched Trump's yeah. Mar-a-Lago, some guy shows up, it's Cincinnati FBI.
And dies.
Gives his life. For what? For what?
Yeah.
So what's going on there? I don't know. I wasn't him. But in the context of our conversation, I would conjecture to say that with a disconnection from life, a direct disconnection from life, and still needing to believe and have the experience and aliveness of believing in something, that soul latched on to the nearest thing.
So regardless of where you're at in life, your connection or wanting or needing to connect to life never goes away. So if you don't get it in a positive way, you will find another way. Like you said, violence just to feel. We need to feel. And if we can't get it one way, we're going to get it another. It's kind of like children, like, I need attention and I'm going to get good attention or bad attention. Doesn't matter what kind of attention I'm going to get, but they need the attention. So it's the job of the parent to give them either positive or negative attention, depending on what they're.
You see, all the traditions in one way or another speak about wellness as inhabiting our kinship with all of life, and speak about dis-ease
right.
as the illness is being disconnected from that kinship with other life and ultimately with ourselves.
So when there is some sort of dis-ease within our body, because I talk a lot about health on the show, and I've had a lot of experts on the show in regards to body health, and a lot of people don't understand that the body is built to be healthy. It is designed to be healthy at all times. If not, it would be a horrible machine. You know, it wasn't made in Detroit to fail in 10 years. Like that's not what it's built to do. So when there's disease, it's because the fuel you're giving it is not proper, or there's other things, environmental things, or even just emotional baggage that you don't deal with.
Sure.
Brings me to my question to you. What do you think was the cause of both of those lumps in your life, other than obviously the catalyst to the spiritual mission? And that could be the end of it. But do you think there was other things?
I feel that we don't cause, I don't think anybody causes their own cancer.
Sure.
But I do think that we contribute to how things show up. So for example, if there's a bridge and there's a weak point in the bridge, when a hurricane comes, that's where it's going to break. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I caused the cancer, but it's not by accident that that tumor appeared on the creative side of my brain.
Right.
Because I was so driven. I was out of balance.
Right.
So that was the weak point in my bridge. So I think that we contribute to where the, you know, I don't think anyone creates their own. I mean, certainly in certain cases, like if you drink and you're an alcoholic.
Drink or smoking or drugs.
But, as we get more into the out of the addictive cycle, that in the quote normal spectrum, you know, it's like trees that you know, they get nicks, they get disease, they get worms, then there's parts, branches fall off in storms. Well, human beings, we're no different, and we keep the life force going, and then we adapt and we heal and we grow around the scars that come our way. And it's incumbent, yes, it was incumbent on me. I mean, I was thrown into being drawn and not being driven, but I had to understand how I contributed to that while I was driven, so I didn't re-engage that on the other side.
Fair enough. Are you afraid of dying? And what do you think happens once we do?
Well, I'm not afraid of death. I am afraid of the process to get there.
Everybody wants to go to heaven, but just not now.
Yeah. Well, suffering the way I did during my cancer journey, to imagine, you know, dying, being like that frightens me. And that doesn't mean that's how that will appear when it's time. So I don't know. No one knows, but I think that it's quite possible that we disperse. And, you know, I love the Hindu notion of energy and life force. And it talks about, you know, it has its own trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. Mm-hmm. And Brahma is the eternal, formless, indestructible spirit. That, mm-hmm. It's like the sky. It's like air. Mm-hmm. And then that enters you and me and the microphone and my, you know, my glass of water and my dog, and it enters the life of forms, and no form can last forever. And so that then Shiva comes, and Shiva is known as the transformer, except in the West we call it the destroyer, because we self-centeredly say, well, that's when I'm going to die. But what that's doing is releasing that universal portion of spirit back into Brahma. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that it's quite possible that, and it's just a guess, but, you know, we in the West think of reincarnation as we make too much of a cartoon out of it.
Right.
You know, right. And of course, and everyone comes, you know, was or comes back as King Tut or something.
Obviously, I was Alexander the Great. Obviously.
Right.
Obviously.
But I think, you know, it makes more sense, like nature, that, you know, perhaps when I die, part of me will become part of the wind, and maybe part of me will become part of the nail that holds the barn together, and maybe part of me will become the comb that some young innocent girl will find her own beauty with, and who knows?
Right. That's it. I just wanted to ask you that question because I was really interested to hear your answer. Now, Mark, I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all of my guests. What is the definition? What is your definition of living a good life?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Oh, my definition of living a good life is being fully present with an open heart to inhabit heaven here.
What is your mission in this life?
Oh, simply to be open-hearted and kind.
And what is the ultimate purpose of life?
The ultimate, and this sounds kind of like it's tautology, but I think the ultimate purpose of life is to animate everything with life, have everything be as fully alive as possible, and the rest will take care of itself. You know, Thomas Merton, who was a wonderful Trappist monk and a great writer who believed in all the traditions, he said, you know, if we truly beheld each other, we would fall down and worship each other. And so, you know, the purpose of life is just to live out in the open because, you know what, everything in nature, every plant, every tree, every bush, it grows to the light. So if we let our light out, we'll just grow to each other.
Beautiful. And where can people find out more about you and your books and the work that you're doing?
Oh, yeah, thanks. So there's marknepo.com, which has all the places I'm teaching. And like I said, my new book is coming out. It's already up for pre-order on Amazon and other places. And then live.marknepo.com has all the kind of the web and online teaching I do, webinars that I offer and things like that.
Mark, it has been, oh my God, such a beautiful conversation and such a pleasure meeting a soul like yourself, my friend. Thank you for doing the work you do, and I look forward to having you back on the show, hopefully quickly, because I just absolutely just love talking to you. I think it was a very, very fascinating conversation. Hopefully it will help some people out there. So I appreciate you, my friend.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks for your good work. I'm glad to be a part of it.
I want to thank Mark so much for coming on the show and just sharing his wisdom and knowledge with all of us. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to pick up his seminal book, The Book of Awakening, head over to the show notes at nextlevelsoul.com/121. And if you've only been listening to this over podcast and you want to watch these amazing conversations, please subscribe to our YouTube channel at nextlevelsoul.com/YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, trust the journey. It is here to teach you. I'll talk to you soon.